Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts. Here's Daniel's prompt.
Hey there, Herman and Corin. So my day was spent in not the way one wants to spend their weekend typically, which was debugging networking issues. I thought I was going to get one day away from my computer. You know, I had high hopes. And something went wrong with our network because, you know, nothing was working. So it took me a while to get onto the ISP. I tried kind of everything locally and then thought, okay, this actually might be a carrier side issue. So I called on my ISP and I was speaking to them for a while. So we have, as you guys probably know, fiber optic internet, which was a great turn of events for me because I struggled for many years with slow internet. That made it really difficult to do things like upload videos to YouTube for my channel. But in the process of trying to get this working, I was learning about PPPoE, point-to-point networking over Ethernet. There's also some different types of point-to-point networking. And of course, I was working also with the wonderful ChatGPT AI tools, which were kind of explaining to me what we were looking and what the information I was relaying to the ISP meant. And it struck me that this is very complicated, very, very complicated. And that kind of makes me wonder, how does this stuff actually work? So you have an ISP in any given country providing internet connectivity to, you know, potentially millions of people. But the ISP has to get the internet, their own internet from a place. And then you ask the next question, which is, well, who is the ISP to the ISP? And at some point, that internet traffic gets kind of bundled up and travels through a submarine internet cable. And then that's kind of the story of the internet, that it's actually, there's no start and end to it. It's just a big connection of cables at the end of the day, whether they are fiber optic cables or they reach the consumers at the, you know, as coaxial or DSL and older technologies. But basically, you know, if you think of, I guess thinking of it as a chain in that sense is actually kind of wrong because it's just upstream. So to get to my question, how do ISPs in practice manage this process of provisioning internet connectivity to consumers? Because when I was trying to understand what my ISP was doing and trying to diagnose, they're able to tell me like if the internet they're supplying to my box is okay. So that means, I presume, that the ISP can maintain some kind of connection to a gigantic amount of devices, which is really impressive that, you know, all these networks fit together so well that they can just kind of ping any consumer endpoint and see exactly what's up with their line. So how does it work in practice that an ISP, you know, if you were to manage their network, they're sending it out to through these connections like point-to-point internet for maybe more advanced consumers and tinkerers like me, managed hardware for your average client. And then they're all patching that upstream to whoever supplies them as internet through presumably a whole different set of protocols. And then out to the switch, which I know here in Israel, I think connects to Greece. And through Haifa, there's a couple of landing points for submarine cables, which would be a fascinating topic for a separate episode, I think. But let's just chat today about the actual process of getting to that point from the ISP's perspective. Herman and Corin, how does it work?
Welcome to My Weird Prompts. I am Corin, and I am joined, as always, by my brother.
Herman Poppleberry, reporting for duty. And man, do we have a deep one today. Our housemate Daniel was actually wrestling with some serious network gremlins over the weekend right here in our house in Jerusalem. He was diving into the guts of point-to-protocol over Ethernet, or triple PoE, and fiber optic systems while trying to figure out why the internet was acting up.
It is funny how we take the internet for granted until that little light on the router turns red. Then suddenly, you are trying to understand the difference between a modem and an optical network terminal at 2 a.m. Daniel's struggle really highlights how complex the invisible infrastructure around us has become.
It really has. And what is fascinating is that the topic he sent us today is about that entire journey, not just the router in our living room, but how an internet service provider, or ISP, actually manages to provision connectivity to millions of people simultaneously. It is this massive coordinated dance of protocols, hardware, and literal glass threads buried under the ocean.
I think most people imagine the internet as this amorphous cloud, but as Daniel pointed out after his research, it is actually just a very long, very expensive chain of cables. I want to start with the consumer end, though. When Daniel was talking about triple PoE, that felt like a bit of a throwback. Why are we still using protocols that feel like they belong in the dial-up era when we have gigabit fiber?
That is a great place to start. Triple PoE, or point-to-point protocol over Ethernet, is essentially a way for the ISP to identify who you are and manage your session. Think of it like a digital passport control. Back in the day, point-to-point protocol was used for dial-up because you were literally making a direct phone call to the ISP. When we moved to broadband, the ISP still needed a way to authenticate users, handle billing, and assign IA preaddresses.
So, it is basically a legacy wrapper. But does it not add overhead? If I am on a 2 gigabit fiber connection, is my router wasting time doing this handshake every time I want to watch a video?
It does add a tiny bit of overhead, usually about 8 bytes per packet. For most people, it is negligible, but for power users or people with very high-speed connections, it can actually become a bottleneck for the router's processor. That is why some modern ISPs are moving toward DHCP, or Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, which is much leaner. But triple PoE is still incredibly popular because it allows the ISP to easily terminate your...
That makes sense from their perspective, even if it is a headache for the user to configure. Now, let us talk about the hardware. Daniel mentioned fiber optic systems. In our neighborhood, we have seen the crews digging up the streets for years to lay these cables. What is actually happening when that fiber line enters our house? It is not just a faster version of the old copper phone lines, right?
Not at all. It is a fundamental shift in physics. With the old DSL or cable systems, you were sending electrical pulses over copper. Copper has resistance. It generates heat. And it is susceptible to electromagnetic interference. If your neighbor uses a microwave or there is a lightning storm, your signal can degrade. Fiber optics use photons. We are talking about pulses of laser light traveling through strands of glass that are about the thickness of a human hair.
And that light stays inside the glass because of total internal reflection, right?
Exactly. The core of the fiber is surrounded by a cladding that reflects the light back inward. Because light travels so fast and does not suffer from electrical interference, we can send massive amounts of data over huge distances without the signal fading. But here is the tricky part Daniel was looking at, the ONT, or optical network terminal. That is the little box on the wall that the fiber plugs into. Its job is to turn those flashes of light back into electrical signals that your router can understand.
I remember when we first got fiber installed. The technician was very careful not to bend the cable too sharply. He said if you kink a fiber line, the light just stops. It is much more fragile than the old coaxial cables we used to have.
Oh, definitely. If you bend it too much, the light hits the cladding at the wrong angle and just escapes into the plastic jacket instead of reflecting back into the core. It is called a macro bend loss. But once that signal is in the ONT and converted to Ethernet, that is where the ISP's provisioning system kicks in. They have to make sure that the specific ONT in our house is authorized to access their network. They usually do this by checking the serial number of the ONT.
So even before I put in my username and password for the internet session, the hardware itself has to be whitelisted. This brings up an interesting point about the last mile. That is the term for the connection from the ISP's local hub to the consumer's house. How do they manage that for millions of people? It seems like an incredible amount of cable.
It is, and they use something called a PON, or passive optical network. This is a brilliant bit of engineering. Instead of running a dedicated fiber line from the central office all the way to every single house, which would be insanely expensive, they run one high-capacity fiber to a neighborhood and then use a splitter. A single fiber can be split to serve 32 or even 64 different customers.
Wait, if the fiber is split, does that mean I am sharing my bandwidth with 64 neighbors? Is it like the old cable modem days, where the internet got slow at 7 PM when everyone started watching movies?
In theory, yes, it is a shared medium. But the total capacity of that one fiber line is so high, often tens of gigabits per second, that you rarely notice it. Plus, the ISP uses time division multiplexing. Basically, the ONT in your house and the ONT in your neighbor's house take turns sending data in incredibly small time slices. They are synchronized down to the nanosecond.
That is wild! The level of coordination required just to get a packet from our living room to the local exchange is staggering, and we have not even left Jerusalem yet.
We are just getting started, but before we head upstream to the big backbone cables, I think we should take a quick break for our sponsors.
Good idea. Let us hear from Larry.
You worried about the security of your Hyundai? You wanted to fight snugly over your Rider wireless antennas? Not only does a Block 99 crafted LED Lebline cozy that fits snugly over your wireless antennas, not only does a BIM block 99% of harmful outside signals, but it also features a built-in lavender diffuser. Why fuser treat? Pelnail simit pounce, chamel sinal sinokani uplink.
Thanks, Larry. I'm not sure lead lining your router is the best way to get a good signal, but I suppose the lavender is a nice touch.
Paranoia. Purple. Truly a color for our times. Anyway, back to the infrastructure. We have made it from our house to the ISP's local exchange. Now, how does the ISP get their internet? As Daniel asked, who is the ISP get their internet? As Daniel asked, who is the ISP's ISP?
This is where we get into the world of tires. Most of the ISPs we deal with as consumers, like Bezeq or Hot here in Israel, or Comcast and AT&T in the States, are what we call Tier 2 or Tier 3 providers. They have their own regional networks, but they do not own the global backbone. To get to the rest of the world, they have to connect to Tier 1 providers.
And Tier 1 providers are the giants, right? Companies like Lumen, formerly CenturyLink, or Telia, or Zayo. These are companies that own the massive intercontinental fiber networks and peer with each other without paying for transit.
Exactly. A Tier 1 network is one that can reach every other part of the internet without paying anyone else for the privilege. They have peering agreements. It is like a global club where everyone agrees to carry each other's traffic for free because the exchange is mutually beneficial. If you are a Tier 2 provider, you usually have to pay a Tier 1 provider for transit to get your customers' data to the other side of the world.
So, when I send an email to a friend in New York, my data goes from our ONT to the local Jerusalem exchange, then probably to a major data center in Tel Aviv, and then it has to find a way out of the country.
Right, and for Israel, that means going underwater. This is the part Daniel found so fascinating. We are essentially an island when it comes to data. Almost all of our international traffic goes through submarine cables at the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea.
I remember reading about the landing stations. There are major ones in Haifa and Ashkelon. These cables are like the carotid arteries of the nation's economy.
They really are. And these are not just cables. They are engineering marvels. A modern submarine cable like the Blue Raymond system, which Google has been working on to connect Italy to India via Israel, can carry hundreds of terabits per second. These cables are armored with steel and buried under the seabed near the coast to protect them from boat anchors and sharks. But once they get to the deep ocean, they are surprisingly thin, maybe the diameter of a garden hose.
It is amazing to think that the entire world's communication relies on a few dozen garden hoses at the bottom of the ocean. What happens when one of them breaks? We have seen news reports about ships dragging anchors and cutting cables.
That is where the mesh nature of the internet comes in. This is a concept called BGP, or Border Gateway Protocol. It is essentially the GPS of the internet. Every major network on Earth tells its neighbors which IP addresses it can reach. If a cable in the Mediterranean is cut, the BGP routers automatically realize that the path is gone, and they start rerouting traffic through other available cables, maybe through a different landing station, or even a longer route through another country.
But that must cause massive latency, right? If my traffic suddenly has to go through a backup cable that is already at 90% capacity, everything slows down.
Oh, absolutely. We saw this back in early 2024 when several cables in the Red Sea were damaged. It did not break the internet, but it caused significant slowdowns across East Africa and parts of Asia. The internet is designed to be resilient, but it is not infinite. This is why ISPs spend so much money on redundancy. They do not just buy capacity on one cable, they buy it on three or four different systems owned by different companies.
This brings us back to Daniel's question about how they manage all of this. It is not just about the cables, it is about the software that manages the traffic. You mentioned BGP, but how does an ISP decide which path to take? Is it just the fastest one?
Not always. Often it is the cheapest one. This is the business side of the internet that most people do not see. ISPs have routing policies. If they have a peering agreement with a neighbor that is free, they will try to send as much traffic as possible through that neighbor, even if it is slightly slower than a paid transit route. It is a constant balancing act between performance and cost.
It is like a giant game of logistics, but let us bring it back down to earth for a second. For someone like Daniel, or any of our listeners who are troubleshooting their own network, why does understanding this help?
I think it helps because it changes your perspective on where the problem might be. When your internet is slow, most people assume it is the Wi-Fi. And to be fair, 90% of the time, it is the Wi-Fi. But by understanding the chain, you can start to isolate the issues. If you can ping your router, but you cannot ping the ISP's gateway, the problem is likely the last mile fiber connection or the triple PoE session. If you can reach local websites but international ones,
that is a great point. It is about narrowing down the fault domain. If Daniel knows his triple PoE session is active, he knows the ONT and the fiber line are working. He can then look at things like DNS or domain name system, which is another layer of the provisioning process.
DNS is huge. That is the phone book of the internet. When you type in a website name, your ISP's DNS server tells your computer the IP address. If the ISP's DNS server is slow or overloaded, it feels like the whole internet is broken, even if the underlying fiber is perfectly fine. That is why a lot of tinkerers, as Daniel called himself, often switch their routers to Howitz, a dancy.yourtrims3ekin.
I have done that myself. It often makes the internet feel much snappier, because the lookups happen faster. So, we have the physical fiber, the ONT, the triple PoE session, the ISP's internal network, the peering points, and the submarine cables. It is a massive stack of technology. What do you think is the biggest misconception people have about this whole system?
I think the biggest misconception is that the internet is wireless. We talk about the cloud and Wi-Fi and 5G. But the reality is that the wireless part is only the very last few feet, or maybe the last couple of miles if you are on a cell tower. The other 99% of the internet's journey is through physical, tangible materials. It is glass, it is copper, it is massive data centers that consume as much power as a small city. We are still very much tethered the heart.
It is a very grounded reality. For something that feels so ethereal. And as we move into 27 and beyond, that infrastructure is only going to get more complex. We are seeing more satellite constellations like Starlink, which add another layer to the mix.
Starlink is fascinating because it is essentially trying to move the backbone into space. Instead of submarine cables, they are using laser links between satellites. It is still a physical chain, just one that is orbiting at 17,000 miles per hour. But for most of us, the fiber in the ground is still going to be the gold standard for a long time because of the sheer capacity of glass.
So, for the practical takeaways today, first, if you are having issues, check your hardware. Make sure your fiber isn't kinked and your ONT is happy. Second, understand your protocol. If your ISP uses triple PoE, your router is doing more work than if it used DHCPP. And third, do not be afraid to change your DNS. It is one of the easiest ways to improve your browsing experience without spending a dime.
And maybe most importantly, have some sympathy for the network engineers. Managing a network that serves millions of people while the ground is literally shifting and cables are being snagged by anchors is a monumental task. It is a monumental task. It is a miracle that it works as well as it does.
It really is. Well, I think we have successfully followed the thread from Daniel's living room to the bottom of the sea.
It has been a journey. And hey, if you have been enjoying our deep dives into the plumbing of the digital world, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It genuinely helps other curious people find the show.
Definitely. We love hearing from you all. You can find all our past episodes and a contact form at myweirdprompts.com. This has been My Weird Prompts.
Thanks to Daniel for the great prompt. We will see you all next week.
Goodbye, everyone.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.